The Saffron Robe by Tuesday Lobsang Rampa, read to you by Blue Friend. Chapter 11. Together we walked down the corridors until at last we reached the inner courtyard, where monk grooms were already holding two horses, one for my guide, the Lama Mingyar Dondup, and the other for unfortunate me. My guide motioned to a groom to help me mount, and I was glad my legs were bad, because a horse and I rarely arrived at the same point together. If I went to mount a horse, the horse moved, and I fell to the ground. Or, if I expected the horse to move and took a cunning jump, the horse did not move, and I jumped right over the wretched creature. But this time, with the excuse of my injured legs, I was helped upon that horse, and immediately I did one of those things which are not done. I started riding away without my guide. He laughed out loud as he saw me, knowing that I had no control over that unfortunate horse. The horse strode away out of the courtyard and down the path. I, clutching on for dear life, afraid of rolling over the mountainside. Around by the outer wall I rode. A fat and friendly face peered out a window just above and called, "Goodbye, Lobsang. Come again soon. We'll have some fresh barley in next week. Good stuff. Better stuff than we've been having lately. You call and see me as soon as you come." The cook monk heard another horse coming and turned his eyes leftward and let out a, "Oi, oi, oi, honorable medical lama, forgive me." My guide was coming, and the poor cook monk thought he had taken an impertinence, but my guide's friendly smile soon put him at ease. I rode off down the mountain, my guide chuckling behind me. "We shall have to coat the horse with glue for you, Lobsang," he chortled. I looked back rather glumly at him. It was all right for him. He was a big man, some 6 feet tall and more than 200 pounds in weight. He had muscles, he had brains, and I had no doubt that if he felt like it, he could pick up that horse and carry it down the mountainside instead of the horse carrying him. I, on the other hand, felt like a fly perched on the creature. I had little control over the thing, and every so often, out of the perverseness of its nature and knowing that I was scared stiff, it would go to the very edge of the path and stare straight down at the willow grove so far below, neighing, presumably, with amusement as it did so. We reached the bottom of the mountain and went along the Dopedal Road because, before going on to Shakpori, we had a call to make in one of the offices of the government in the village of Sho. Arrived there, my guide very considerately tied my horse to a post and lifted me off, saying, "Now you just stay around here, Lobsang. I shall not be more than 10 minutes. He picked up a bag and strode off into one of the offices, leaving me sitting on a pile of stones. "There, there," said a countrified voice behind me. "I saw the Lama of the Saffron Robe get off that horse, and here is his boy to look after the horses. How do you do, young master?" I looked around and saw a small group of pilgrims. They had their tongues out in the traditional Tibetan greeting with which the inferiors greeted their superiors. My chest swelled with pride. I basked unashamedly in the glory reflected from being the boy of the Lama of the Saffron Robe. "Oh," was my reply, "you should never come upon a priest unexpectedly like that. We are always engaged in meditation, you know, and a sudden shock is very bad for our health." I frowned rather disapprovingly as I looked towards them and continued, "My master and guide, the Lama Mingyar Dondup, the wearer of the saffron robe, is one of the most important lamas here. He is a very great person indeed, and I should not advise you to get too near his horse, because his horse, too, is important, bearing such a great rider. But get along now, get along. Don't forget your circuit of the ring road. It will bring much good to you." With that, I turned away, hoping that I had acted as a true monk should, hoping that I had made a favorable impression. A chuckle near me made me look up rather guiltily. A trader was standing there, picking at his teeth with a piece of straw, one hand on hip, the other hand very busy with his mouth. Hastily I looked around and saw the pilgrims had, as ordered, continued on their round. "Well, what do you want?" I said to the old trader, who was peering at me through screwed lip eyes. His face seamed and wrinkled with the years. "I have no time to waste," I said. The old fellow smiled benignly. "Now, now, young master, don't be so harsh on a poor old trader who's had such a difficult time making a living in these hard, hard days. Do you happen to have any trinkets with you? Anything I can offer you, a very good price for cuttings from a lama's hair, or for a piece of lama's robe, I can offer you a better price for anything that has been blessed by one of the higher lamas, such as your master of the saffron robe. Speak up, young master, speak up, before he comes back and catches us." I sniffed as I looked at him, and I thought, not if I had a dozen robes would I sell for things to be traded by fakes and charlatans. Just then, to my joy, I saw my guide coming. The old trader saw him too and made off with a shambling gait. "What are you trying to do, buy up trades?" asked my guide. "No, honorable master," was my response. "He was trying to buy up you, or any bits or pieces of you, hair pieces, robe clippings, or anything which he thinks I should have been able to steal from you." The Lama Mingyar Dondup laughed, but there was a rueful sort of ring to his laugh as he turned and stared after the trader, who was not tarrying, but really hurrying to get out of calling range. "It's a pity these fellows are always on the make. It's a pity they try to get something and give it a false value. After all, it is not the saffron robe that matters, but the soul of the wearer of the saffron robe." So saying, he lifted me in one swift, easy motion and put me astride my horse, which looked as surprised as I felt. Then he untied the reins, giving them to me, as if I knew what to do with them, and, mounting his own horse, we rode off. Down the Mani Lakhand we went, past the rest of the village of Sho, past the Pargo Kaling, and then over the little bridge which spanned a tributary of the Kaling Shu. We took the next turn left, passing the small Kundu Park, and taking the next road left to our own Chakpori. This was a rough and stony road, a hard road to traverse, a road which needed a sure-footed horse. Iron Mountain, as was our name for Shakpori, is higher than the mountain on which the Potala is erected, and our pinnacle of rock was smaller, sharper, and steeper. My guide led the way, his horse every so often dislodging small stones which rolled down the path towards me. My horse followed, carefully picking a path. As we rode up, I looked over to my right, to the south, where flowed the Happy River, the Kaishu. I could also see straight down into the Jewel Park, the Norbulinga, where the inmost one had his very few moments of recreation. At present, the park was very much deserted, except for a few monk gardeners straightening up after the recent tempest. There were no senior lamas in sight. I thought how, before my legs were damaged, I liked to slither down the mountainside and duck across the Lingor Road and go into the Jewel Park, or Norbulinga, by what I thought was my own super-secret way. We reached the top of the mountain. We reached the stony space before the Shakpori walls, walls which enclosed the whole of that lamasery. The monk at the gate quickly welcomed us in. Two other monks hurried to take our horses from us. I parted from mine with the greatest of joy, but groaning somewhat as the weight fell upon my legs once again. "I shall have to see about your legs, Lobsang. They are not healing so well as I expected," said my guide. A monk took the lama's luggage and hurried off with it. He turned and made his way into the lamasery, calling over his shoulder, "I will see you again in an hour's time." The Potala was too public for me, too grand. One always had to be alert in case one accidentally annoyed a senior monk or a junior lama. The senior lamas never took offense. They had greater things to worry about than whether a person was looking in their direction or apparently ignoring them. As in all cases, it is only the inferior men who create commotions. Their superiors were kind, considerate, and understanding. I wandered into the courtyard, thinking that this would be a good opportunity to have a meal. At that stage of my career, food was one of the most important things because Sampa, with all its virtues, still left one feeling quite a bit hungry. As I walked the well-known corridors, I met many of my contemporaries, boys who had entered at much the same time as I had. But now there was a great change. I was not just another boy, not just another young lad to be trained or to be fought with. Instead, I was under the special protection of the great Lama Mingyur Dondup, the wearer of the saffron robe. Already rumor had leaked out and spread abroad that I was going to be specially taught, that I was going to have a room in the Lama's quarters, that I was going to do this, that I was going to do that, and I was amused to notice that my exploits, real or imagined, were already well known. One boy chortled gleefully to another that he had actually seen me picked from the ground by a great gust of wind and blown up on the top of the golden roof. "I saw it with my very own eyes," he said. "I was standing here at this very spot, and I saw him down there sitting on the ground. Then this great dust storm came, and I saw Lobsang sailing upwards. He looked as if he was fighting devils on the roof, and then... The boy paused dramatically and rolled his eyes for emphasis. And then he fell down right into the arms of one of the temple keeper lamas. There was a sigh of awe, admiration, and envy all mixed up, and the boy continued. And then Lobsang was taken to the inmost one, which brought distinction and honor to our class. I pushed my way through the throng of sensation seekers, the horde of small boys and junior monks who were hoping that I would make some startling announcement, a sort of revelation from the gods. But I was in search of food. I pushed my way through that throng and stumped off down the corridor to a well-known spot, the kitchen. "Ah, so you've returned to us, eh? Well, sit ye down, lad, sit ye down. I'll feed you up well. You've not been too well fed at the Patala by the look of you. Sit ye down, and I'll feed you." The old cook monk came and patted my head and pushed me back so that I was sitting on a pile of empty barley sacks. Then he fished inside my robe and managed to get my bowl. Off he went, carefully cleaning my bowl already, not that it needed it, and off to the nearest of the cauldrons. Soon he was back, slopping sampa and tea all over the place, making me draw up my legs in case I got it over my robe. "There, there, boy," he said, pushing the bowl into my hands. Eat up, because I know you will be sent for soon. The abbot wants to hear all about what happened." Fortunately, someone else came in and wanted attention, so he turned away from me and went off, leaving me to eat my sampa. With that matter disposed of, I thanked him politely, because he was a good old man who thought that boys were nuisances, but they were not such nuisances if they were fed properly. I went to the great bin of fine sand and carefully cleaned my bowl once again, taking the broom and sweeping up the sand which I had spilled on the floor. I turned and bowed in his direction, to his pleased surprise, and made my way out. I went to the end of the corridor and rested my arms against the wall while I peered out. Below me was the swamp. A bit beyond that was the flowing stream. But I was looking over the Kashya Linga towards the ferry, because the boatman appeared to be most uncommonly busy today. He was standing there, leaning on his oars, pushing away at them, working hard, and his yak-skin boat seemed to be absolutely laden down with people and their bundles, and I wondered what it was all about, why there were so many people flocking to our holy city. Then I remembered the Russians. The Russians had been putting a lot of pressure on our country because the British had been making a commotion also, and now the Russians were sending a lot of spies into Lhasa disguised as traders and thinking that we poor, ignorant natives would never know. They forgot, or perhaps never even knew, that many of the lamas were telepathic and clairvoyant, and knew what they were thinking almost as soon as they themselves knew. I loved to stand and watch and see all the different types of people, and to divine their thoughts, determine whether they were good or bad. With practice, it was easy, but now was hardly the time for standing staring at others. I wanted to go and see my guide. I wanted to be able to lie down. My legs were hurting me, and I was really tired. My guide had had to go away to the wild rose fence before I was really well enough to get about my business. Actually, I should have been between my blanket on the floor for another week, but the Shakpori, good place though it was, it really did not welcome small boys who were ill, who had wounds which were slow to heal, and who broke the regular routine. So it was that I had had to go to the Putala, where there were, curiously enough, more facilities for such attentions than in our Temple of Healing. At Shakpori, suitable students were taught the healing arts. We were taught all about the body, how the different parts of the body work, and we were taught acupuncture, in which very thin needles are pushed into the body to stimulate certain nervous centers. And we were taught about herbs, how to gather herbs after having been able to identify them, how to prepare them, store them, and dry them. In the Shakpori, we had large buildings in which monks under the supervision of lamas were always preparing ointments and herbs. I remembered the first time that I had seen them. I peered through the doorway, hesitant, scared, not knowing what I would see, not knowing who would see me. I was curious because, although my studies had not yet reached the stage of herbal medicine, I was still vastly interested. So I peered. The room was large. It had a high, raftered roof, and from great beams which stretched from side to side and held up a triangular arrangement of frames, ropes descended. For a time I looked, not being able to understand the purpose of those ropes. Then, as my eyes became sharper in the somewhat dim interior, I saw that the other end of the ropes were attached to leather bags. Leather bags, which by suitable treatment were as hard as wood. Each leather bag had a word painted on it, words which meant not a thing to me. I watched, and no one took any notice of me until at last an old lama turned and saw me. He smiled quite kindly and said, "Come in, my boy, come in. I'm pleased indeed to see that one so young is already taking an interest. Come in." Hesitantly, I walked towards him, and he put a hand on my shoulder, and to my amazement, he started telling me about the place, pointing out the different herbs, telling me the difference between herb powder, herb tea, and herb ointment. I liked the old man. He seemed to have been remarkably sweetened by his herbs. Just in front of us there was a long table of stone, a rather rough type of stone. I would not like to say what sort of stone it was, but it was probably granite. It was level and about 15 feet by 6 feet, one large solid slab. Along its sides, monks were very busy spreading herb lumps. That is the only word I can think of to describe them, because they seem to be clotted lumps of herbs, a mass of brownish vegetation. They spread these herbs on the table, and then, with flat pieces of stone, something like bricks, they press down on the herbs, dragging the stone towards the side. As they lifted, I found that the herbs were being macerated, or shredded. They kept on and kept on, until it seemed that only a fibrous pulp was left, When they reached that stage, they stood back and other monks approached with leather pails and stones with a serrated edge. Carefully, the fresh lot of monks scraped the stone bench, scraped all the fibrous matter into their leather pails. With that done, the original monks spread fine sand on the bench and started rubbing it with their stones, cleaning it and, at the same time, making fresh scratches which would hold the herbs so that they could be shredded. The monks, with their leather pails, took the fibrous material to the far side of the large room where, I now saw, there were steaming cauldrons of water. One after the other, they took their pails and emptied the contents into one of the cauldrons. I was interested to see that it had been bubbling and steaming, but as soon as the new fibrous stuff was put in, the boiling point stopped. The old lama took me across and looked in, and then he picked up a stick and stirred the stuff, saying, "Look, we are boiling this, and we are keeping on boiling it until the water boils away and we get a thick syrup. I will show you what we do with that." He led me across to another part of the hall, and there I saw great jars full of syrup, all labeled with their different identities. "This," he remarked, pointing to one particular jar, "is what we give to those suffering from catarrhal infections. They have a small amount of this to drink, and while the taste is not very pleasant, it is much more pleasant than the catarrh. Anyways, it cures them." He chuckled in high good humor, then led me to another table in an adjacent room. Here I found that a group of monks were working on a stone bench. It seemed to be a shallow trough. They had wooden paddles in their hands, and they were mixing up a whole collection of things under the supervision of another lama. The old lama, who was giving me such a pleasant, conducted tour, said, "Here we have oil of eucalyptus, together with oil of camphor. We mix that with some highly expensive imported olive oil, and then, with these wooden paddles, the monks stir everything up and mix it with butter. The butter forms a fine base for an ointment. When we have people with chest afflictions, they find relief when this is rubbed on their chest and back." Gingerly, I stretched out a finger and touched a blob of the stuff on the edge of the trough. Even more cautiously, I sniffed it, and I even felt my eyes going crossed. The smell seemed to burn right through me. It seemed as if my lungs were going to burn inside out, and I was afraid to cough, although I badly wanted to, in case I should explode. The old lama laughed, and he said, "Now put that on your nose, and it will take the skin out of your nostrils. That is the concentrated stuff. It has to be diluted yet with more butter." Farther along, monks were stripping the tips off the leaves of a certain dried plant and carefully sifting it through a cloth, which was very close mesh net. These monks are preparing special teas. By tea, we mean an admixture of herbs which can be drunk. "This particular tea," he turned and pointed, "is an antispasmodic tea, and it gives relief in cases of nervous twitchings. When you come here and take your turn at all of this, you will find it extremely interesting." Just then someone called to him, but he said before leaving, Look around, my boy, look around. I'm glad indeed to see one who is so interested in our arts." With that he turned and hurried off to the other room. I wandered about, taking a sniff of this and a sniff of that. I took one particular powder and sniffed it so much that it got up my nostrils and down my throat, and it made me cough and cough and cough, until another lama came and gave me a drink of tea. Beastly stuff it was, too. I recovered from that incident and walked to a far wall, where there was a great barrel. I looked at it and I was amazed, because it seemed to be full of a bark, a curious-looking bark, bark such as I had never seen before. I touched a piece and it was crumbly to my fingers. I put my head sideways in some astonishment, because I couldn't see what use there would be for such dirty old pieces of bark, rough and dirtier than anything I had seen in our parks. A lama looked at me, came over, and said, "So you've no idea what this is, eh?" "No, honorable medical lama," I replied. "It seems to me to be just rubbish." He laughed at that. He really was highly amused, as he said, "That, young man, is a bark which is used for the most common ailment in the world today, a bark which gives relief and which has saved many lives. Can you guess what it is? What is the most common ailment?" He really had me puzzled there, and I thought and thought and could not come up with any sensible solution, and I told him so. He smiled as he told me, "Constipation, young man, constipation, the biggest curse of the world. But this is a sacred bark which we import by traders from India. It is called sacred bark because it comes from a very, very distant country, Brazil, where they call it Cascara Sagrada, that is, bark sacred. We use it, again, as a tea, or in exceptional cases we boil and boil and boil it until we have a distillate, which we mix up with a certain collection of chalk and sugars, and then we press it into a pill form. That is for the ones who cannot take its acrid taste as a tea." He smiled kindly at me, obviously pleased at my interest, and it really was interesting. The old lama whom I had first met came hurrying back, asking me how I was managing. And then he smiled as he saw that I was still handling a bit of Cascara Sagrada. "Chew it, my boy, chew it. It will do you a lot of good. It will cure any cough that you have, because you will be afraid to cough after chewing that." He chortled away like a small elf, because although he was a high medical lama, he was still a small man in stature. Over here," he said. "Look at this. This is from our own country. Slippery elm, we call it. The bark of the slippery elm. A very useful thing for people who have gastric disturbances. We mix it up, we make a paste of it, and the unfortunate sufferer takes the stuff, and it relieves his pain. But you wait, my boy, you wait. When you come here a little later on, I'm sure that we shall discover that you have a great future ahead of you." I thanked him and the other lamas for their kindness, and then I left after the first of many visits. But hurrying footsteps, A boy was coming with the order for me to go to my guide, the Lama Mingyar Dondup, who was awaiting me in his own quarters, and which now would be almost mine, because I was going to have a room next door to him. So I wrapped my robe tightly around me, trying to look tidy again, and hurried off as fast as I could. Hurried off to see what sort of place I was going to have. End of chapter 11. Chapter 12. Mine was a pleasant room, small, but still large enough for my requirements. I was gratified indeed to notice that I had two low tables, and one of those low tables had quite a number of magazines and papers on it. On the other table, there were some very nice things laid out for me, those sweet things of which I so heartily approved. As I entered, a monk attendant smiled at me and said, "The gods of fortune have certainly smiled upon you, Lobsang. You are right next door to the High Lama, Mingyar Dondup." I knew that. He was telling me things I already knew. But then he said, "Here is a communicating door. You must remember never to enter that door without permission from your guide, because he may be in deep meditation. Now you cannot see your guide for a little time, so I suggest you get down to that food." With that he turned away and left my room. My room! It sounded good. It was a wonderful thing to have a room of my own after having had to sleep very publicly with a lot of other boys. I walked across to the table, bent down, and carefully examined all the good things displayed there. After a frenzy of uncertainty, I decided which I would have, a sort of a pink thing with a white dusting on top. I picked it up with my right hand, and then for good measure I picked up another with my left hand. Then I went to the window to see just where I was in the building. I rested my arms in the stone of the recessed window frame and poked my head outside, muttering a very unfortunate word as I dropped one of my Indian cakes in the process. Hastily I gobbled up the other, lest it too should share that fate. Then I returned to my scrutiny of the landscape. Here I was at the extreme southeastern part of the building. I had the last room right on the corner of the annex. I could see the Jewel Park, the Norbu Linga. At present there were a number of lamas poking about. They seemed to be having a debate, making quite a number of gestures. For a few idle moments I watched them. They were quite amusing. One was posturing on the ground and the other was declaiming to him. Then they changed places. Oh yes, I knew what they were doing. They were rehearsing for the public debates, because the Dalai Lama himself was going to take part in a public lamastic debate. Satisfied that I had not missed anything that I should know about, I turned to other things. A few pilgrims were pottering along on the Lingor Road, pottering about as if they expected to find gold beneath every bush or beneath every stone. They were a motley collection. Some of them were orthodox pilgrims, really sincere. Others, as I could tell without much trouble, were spies, Russian spies, who were spying upon the Chinese and us, and Chinese spies who were spying on the Russians and on us. I thought that as long as they spied upon each other, they might leave us alone. Right below my window was a swamp with a little river running through it and emptying into the Happy River. There was a bridge over the river which carried the Lingor Road. I watched in some amusement because there was a small group of townsboys there. Blackheads, as we called them, because they hadn't shaven heads as we monks had. They were fooling about on this bridge, throwing little bits of wood over on one side and dashing across to the other side to see them reappear. One boy, overbalanced with suitable assist from one of his companions, and over he went, head first, into the water. However, it was not very serious. He managed to drag himself ashore, covered in a particularly gluey mud, which already I, to my cost, had encountered in that river. Then all the boys rushed down the bank and helped him get clean, because they knew what mother and father would say to each of them if they all went back into Lhasa City and left the boy in such a horrid state. More to the east, the boatman was still plying his trade, ferrying across the river, making a great production of it in the hope of being able to drag a little more money out of his passengers. This was a thing that really interested me, because at that time I had never been on the water in a boat, and at that time it was really the height of my ambition. A little farther along the ferry road was another small park, the Kashya Linga, along the road which led to the Chinese mission. I could actually see the Chinese mission walls from my room, and I could look down on the garden, even though it was well shielded by trees. We boys always thought that horrible atrocities were taking place in the Chinese mission, and who knows, it may be that we were correct. More to the east was the Kati Linga, a very pleasant but somewhat damp park located in swampy ground. Farther away was the turquoise bridge, which I could see, and the sight of which delighted me. I thoroughly enjoyed seeing people enter the covered enclosure, later to emerge at the other end. Beyond the turquoise bridge, I could see the city of Lhasa, the council hall, and, of course, the golden roofs of the Jokang, the Cathedral of Lhasa, which was perhaps the oldest building in our country. Far beyond were the mountain ranges and the dotted hermitages and the great heaps of different lamasaries. Yes, I was well satisfied with my room, and then it occurred to me that I could not see the Potala. Simultaneously, the thought occurred to me that high officials of the Potala could not see me either. So, if I drop pebbles or lumps of sampa onto unsuspecting pilgrims, no one would see me, and the pilgrims would put it down to birds. In Tibet, we did not have beds. We slept on the floor. Most times we did not have cushions or anything else on the floor. We just wrapped ourselves in blankets and lay down, perhaps using our robes as a pillow. But it was not time to retire. Instead, I sat with the window at my back so that the light streamed in over my shoulders, and I picked up a magazine. The title meant nothing to me, because it might have been English, French, or German. I couldn't read any of them. but as I turned to this particular magazine, it appeared to be an Indian one, because they had a sort of map on the cover, and I could recognize some of the names, some of the shapes of the words. I turned over the pages. The words meant nothing to me, and I devoted myself exclusively to the pictures. As I sat there, feeling content, feeling that my lot had changed for the better, I was quite happy to just look at pictures while my thoughts wandered far afield. Idly I turned the pages, and then I stopped and I laughed and laughed and laughed to myself. Here in the two center pages were a collection of men standing on their heads, tying themselves into knots and all sorts of things of that nature. Now I knew what I was seeing. Some of the yoga exercises which were then very much the cult in India. I laughed hard and loud at some of the expressions, then stopped suddenly as I looked up and saw my guide, the Lama Mingyar Dondup, smiling at me through the open communicating door. Before I could scramble to my feet, he waved me down, saying, "No, we want no formality here, Lobsang. Formality is suitable for formal occasions, but this room is your home, just as my room," he mentioned through the open doorway, "is my home. But what was making you laugh so much?" I suppressed my rising mirth and pointed to the yoga pictures. My guide came into the room and sat on the floor with me. "You should not laugh at other people's beliefs, you know, Lobsang, because you wouldn't like other people to laugh at your beliefs. These are practicing yoga. I do not do yoga, nor do any of the high lamas do it. Only those who have no ability to do metaphysical things do yoga." "Master," I said in some excitement, "will you tell me something about yoga? How people do it? What is it? I'm very puzzled about the whole thing." My guide looked at his fingers for a moment and then answered me, saying, "Well, yes, you have to learn about these things. Let us talk about them now. I will tell you something about yoga." I sat and listened while my guide talked. He had been everywhere, and seen everything, and done everything, and I wanted nothing so much as to model myself upon him. I listened with more care than a small boy would normally give as he talked to me. "I am not interested in yoga," he said, "because yoga is merely a means of disciplining the body. If a person already has discipline of the body, then yoga becomes merely a waste of time. In this, our country, no one except the very lower classes ever practices yoga. The Indians have made very much of a cult of yoga, and I regret that exceedingly, because it is leading one away from the real truths. It is conceded that before one can do various metaphysical practices, one must have control of the body, must be able to control one's breathing, one's emotions, one's muscles, but I am opposed to yoga because it is merely trying, by brute force, to do that which should be achieved by spiritual means." While he was talking, I was looking at the pictures, and it did seem remarkable that people should try to tie themselves up in knots, and thinking it was being spiritual. But my guide continued, Many of the lower types of Indians can do a form of trick by indulging in yoga. They are able to do hypnotism and various other tricks, which they have made themselves believe is a truly spiritual thing. Instead, it is a trick and nothing more. I have never heard of anyone going to the heavenly fields on the basis of being able to tie his body up in knots, he said with a laugh. Why do people do such remarkable things? I asked. There are certain things, certain physical manifestations, which can be achieved by yoga, and there is no doubt that if one practices yoga, it can perhaps develop a few muscles, but that does not help in developing spirituality. Many of the Indians put on exhibitions, and such men are called fakirs. They travel from village to village and town to town, putting on yoga exhibitions, perhaps tying oneself up in knots, as you call it, or keeping one's arm above one's head for a long time, or doing other remarkable things. They put on a holy pose as if they're doing the most wonderful thing of all, and because they are a noisy minority who bask in publicity, people have reached the conclusion that yoga is an easy way to reach the great truths. This is completely wrong. Yoga merely assists one to develop or control or discipline the body, and it does not help one achieve spirituality. He laughed and said, "You would hardly believe this, but when I was a very young man, I tried yoga myself, and I found that I was spending so much time trying to do a few childish exercises that I had not sufficient time left to devote to spiritual progress. So, on the advice of a wise old man, I gave up yoga and got down to serious business." He looked at me and then stretched his arm in the direction of Lhasa. He swung it round to include the direction of the Patala, saying, "In all our country, you will not find the higher types of Lama doing yoga. They get down to the real thing, and you will always find that the yogas make a lot of public commotion, saying how wonderful they are, how important they are, and how they have the keys to salvation and spirituality. Yet the true adept of metaphysics does not talk about what he really can do. Unfortunately, in yoga, it is a noisy minority which tries to sway public opinion. My advice to you, Lobsang, is this. Never, never bother with yoga, for it is quite useless to you. You were born with certain powers, clairvoyance, telepathy, and what not, but you have absolutely no need whatever to dabble with yoga. It could even be harmful." While he had been talking, I had been turning the pages quite without thinking, and as I looked down I peered, because I saw what seemed to be a Western man wearing a contorted expression as he was trying to do an exercise. I pointed it out to my guide, who looked at it and said, "Yes, this is a victim of yoga. A Western man who tried an exercise and dislocated a bone in the process. It's a very, very unwise thing for Westerners to try yoga, because their muscles and bones are not supple enough. One should only do yoga if one really wants to, if one is trained from a very early age. For middle-aged people to do it, well, it's foolish and definitely harmful. It is ridiculous, though, to say that the practice of yoga causes illness. It does not. All it does is to bring into use a few muscles, and at a time a person may get a dislocation or a strained muscle, but that is the person's own fault. They should not meddle with such things. He laughed as he folded the paper and said, "The only yogi I have met have been real cranks. They have thought they were the cleverest people ever. They thought that they knew everything, and they thought that the practice of yoga was the salvation of the world. Instead, it's just an exercise, such as when you boys climb a tree or on stilts, and when you run so that a kite may be lofted into the air. Yoga, just a physical exercise, nothing more, nothing spiritual. Possibly it can help one by improving one's physical condition, so that then one is able to forget about yoga and get on with things that matter, the things of the spirit. After all, in a few years, everyone leaves the body. It does not matter then if the body is full of hard muscle and strong bone. The only thing that matters then is the state of the spirit." He returned to the subject, saying, "Oh, and I should warn you of this. Many practitioners of yoga forget theirs is just a physical training cult. Instead, they have taken some of our occult healing practices and said that these healing practices are an adjunct of yoga. Such is completely false. Any of the healing arts can be done by a person entirely ignorant of yoga, and often done far better. So," he pointed at me sternly, "don't you ever fall victim to yoga publicity. It can actually lead you away from the path." He turned and walked into his room. Then he turned back to me, saying, "Oh, I have some charts here, which I want you to fix on your wall. You'd better come and get them." Then he came over to me and lifted me up so that I should not have to struggle getting up by myself. I walked behind him into his room, and there on a table were three rolled papers. He held one up, saying, "This is a very old Chinese picture, which many hundreds of years ago was made in veneered wood. It is at present in the city of Peking. But in this representation, I want you to study carefully how the organs of the body are imitated by monks doing various tasks." He stopped and pointed to one particular thing. "Here," he said, "monks are busy mixing food and fluid. That is the stomach. The monks are preparing all this food to pass through various pipes before it reaches other monks. If you study this, you will get a very good idea of the basic workings of the human body." He rolled up the scroll again, carefully tied it with little tapes which were already affixed to it, and then he took another and held it up for me to see. "Here," he continued, "is a representation of the spine with various chakras. You will see from this how the very different centers of power are located between the base of the spine and the top of the head. This chart must be right in front of you so that you see it last thing at night and first thing in the morning." Carefully he rolled up the scroll and tied that, and then he went on to the next one, the third. He untied the fastening and held the chart at arm's length. "Here is a representation of the nervous system, showing you things which you will have to study, such as the cervical ganglion, the vagus nerve, the cardiac plexus, solar plexus, and pelvic plexus. All these things you have to know because they are quite essential to you as a medical lama in training." I looked at the things, feeling more and more despondent, because it seemed to me that I should never master all these things. All the bits and squiggles of the human body, all the wriggly bits that were nerves and the great blobs that were chakras. But I thought, I've got plenty of time. Let me just go at my own speed, and if I cannot learn as much as I think I should, well, one cannot do more than one's best. Now, I suggest you go and get some air. Just put these in your room, and then whatever you do for the rest of the day is your own affair, unless you get up to some mischief, he said with a smile. I bowed respectfully to him and picked up the three scrolls. Then I returned to my own room, shutting the communicating door between us. For a time I stood in the center of the room wondering how I should fix these wretched things, and then I observed that there were already suitable projections in the wall. Carefully, I took a table and placed it beneath one of the projections. Climbing the table, which gave me another foot, or 18 inches of height, I managed at last to get the cord of the first chart over the projection. Carefully, I retreated to the far side of the room and looked approvingly at my handiwork. No, it was not straight. I eyed the thing critically and hurried forward to make sure that everything was as correct as it should be. Satisfied that one was hanging true and level, I went to work on the next. At last I was satisfied, and I dusted my hands together with an air of complacency. Smiling with self-satisfaction, I walked out of my room, wondering which way to go. But as I went out, passing my guide's door, I saw the serving monk at the end of the corridor. He greeted me in friendly fashion and said, "That's the quickest way out. It's a private door for lamas, but I've been told that you are permitted to use it." He motioned to it, and I thanked him and soon slipped out into the fresh air. I stood outside in the open. The end of the mountain path lay just beneath my feet. Over to the right, a crowd of monks were busy working. It looked to me as if they were leaning up the road, but I did not hang about. I did not want to be sent on any tasks. Instead, I moved directly forward and sat on a boulder for a time while I looked out over the city, not so far away, near enough for me to distinguish in the clear, clear air of Tibet the dress of the traders, the monks, and the lamas who were going about their business. Soon, I moved a few yards down and sat on another rock beside which there was a pleasant small bush. My attention now wandered to the swamp below me. The swamp where the grass was lush and green, and where I could distinguish bubbles as fish lurked in the deeper pools. As I sat, there was a sudden rushing behind me, and a hoarse, throaty voice said, "Prrr, prrr." With that, there was a hearty boink in the small of my back, as a solid, furry head greeted me. I reached round and stroked the old cat, and he licked me with a tongue which was as rough as the gravel on the ground. Then he rushed round to the front, jumped on my lap, jumped off, and made off through some bushes, stopping just in sight, wheeling round to face me. He looked the very picture of inquiry as he sat there, tail straight up, ears straight up, facing towards me with his blue eyes glinting. I made no move, so he rushed up the hill, again towards me, saying, "Prrr, prrr." As I still made no move, he reached out with one of his paws and hooked his claws in the bottom of my robe and gently tugged. "Oh, cat, whatever is the matter with you?" I asked in exasperation. Slowly I scrambled to my feet and looked about to see what the cat was agitating about. There was nothing to be seen, but the cat was rushing towards a bush in the distance, and then rushing back to me and clawing at my robe, so I faced down the mountainside and began a slow, cautious descent, the cat fairly dancing with excitement, whirling round, springing in the air, and charging at me. I clung to the bushes as I made my slow way, and I reached the point where the cat had turned to face me, but there was nothing to be seen. "Cat, you are an idiot," I said with irritation. "You've dragged me down here just to play." "Prrr, prrr," said the cat, clawing at my robe again and weaving between my legs, poking beneath my robe and nibbling at my bare toes showing through my sandals. With a sigh of resignation, I progressed a bit farther, pushed my way through a bush, and clung on grimly because here was a ledge, and had I not been clinging on so grimly, I could have fallen over the edge. I turned to say some very unkind things to Friend Cat, who was now in a frenzy of excitement. Darting around me, he sprang over the edge. My heart nearly stopped with shock, for the old cat was a very good friend of mine, and I thought he had committed suicide. Very cautiously I sank to my knees, and clinging hold of the bushes peered over the edge. About 12 feet below me I saw the body of an aged monk. My horrified eyes saw that his head was blood-stained, and that his robe had also blood on it. His right leg, I perceived, was bent at an unnatural angle. My heart was palpitating with fright, excitement, effort. I looked about me and I found that just off to the left there was a small declivity down which I could descend, finding myself then at the head of the old monk. Gingerly, nearly ready to jump out of my skin with fright, I touched him. He was alive. As I touched him, his eyes flickered feebly and he groaned. I saw that he had fallen over and struck his head on a rock. The cat was now sitting, watching me carefully. Gently, I stroked the old monk's head, stroking beneath the ears, down the neck, towards the heart. After some time, his eyes opened and he looked vacantly about him. Slowly his eyes came into focus, focusing on me. "It's all right," I said soothingly. "I will go up and get help for you. I shall not be very long." The poor old man tried to smile and closed his eyes again. I turned, and on hands and knees, as being the safest and speediest way, I made my way up to the top and rushed across the path into the concealed door of the lamas. As I entered, I nearly collided with the serving monk who was there. "Quick, quick," I said, "there's a monk injured on the rocks." As I was speaking, my guide came out of his room and looked inquiringly at the commotion. "Master, master," I said, "I have just found, with the aid of Honorable Puss-Puss, an old monk who is injured. He has a head injury, and his leg is unnaturally bent. He needs help urgently." My guide speedily gave instructions to the serving monk, and then turned to me. "Lead on, Lobsang, I will follow." Together we went out of Shakpori and crossed the small path. I led him down the steep path, noting with consternation that his saffron robe was getting soiled. My own was so soiled that a few more marks made no difference. Honorable Puss-Puss was there, dancing about on the path ahead of us, and he really looked relieved to see the Lama Mingyar Dondup with me. Soon we reached the old monk, who still had his eyes shut. My guide knelt down beside him and took various packages from the inner pan of his robe, bandages and some stuff which he held on a piece of cloth and held beneath the old monk's nose. The monk sneezed violently and opened his eyes which were strained and pain-racked. He looked a very relieved monk indeed when he saw who was attending to him. "It is all right, friend. Help is coming for you," said my guide. With that, the old monk closed his eyes again and sighed with relief. My guide raised the monk's robe, and we saw bits of bone sticking through the skin of the leg just beneath the knee. My guide said, "Hold his hands, Lobsang. Hold him tightly. Rest your weight so that he cannot move. I'm going to pull the leg straight." With that, he caught hold of the monk's ankle, and with a very swift, sudden pull, straightened the limb, and I saw the bones disappear inside the skin. It was so sudden, so carefully done, that the old man did not even have time to groan. Quickly, my guide reached out two branches, which were very convenient, to hang onto a fairly big bush. With a knife he cut them off, and, padding them with the piece of his own robe, he bound them as a splint on the monk's leg. Then we just sat back to wait. Soon there came shufflings and scufflings as a party of monks, led by a lama, appeared coming down the path. We called to them and directed them to the place where we were. Carefully, they grouped about the old monk. One young monk, not at all carefully, tried to show off and tried to show how sure-footed he was. His foot slipped on the loose stones. His feet slipped out from under him, and he started to slide down the mountainside. A shrub caught the bottom of his robe and pulled it up over his head, and there he was, like a peeled banana, swinging naked to the gaze of pilgrims on the ring road below. My guide chuckled and gave orders for two others to rescue him without delay. When he was pulled back, he was looking very shamefaced and very red-faced, too. I noticed that he would have to stand for a few days if he wanted to be comfortable, because the place in contact with the floor when sitting was quite badly scratched by the stones. Cautiously, the monks turned to the injured man so that they could slide beneath him a length of strong canvas. Then they turned him back and pulled so that he was upon a convenient stretcher. They tucked the cloth right around him, forming a tube of it, and then they slid a stout pole inside, binding him to the pole by broad lengths of webbing. He was unconscious, fortunately, and then two monks raised the ends of the pole, and with others behind, helping by pushing and steadying their footsteps, they made their way slow, cautiously through the bushes, up the mountain path, and into the safety of Shakpuri. I stood patting Honorable Puss-Puss, telling my guide the Lama Mingyar Dondup how Honorable Puss-Puss had fetched me down to come to the aid of the old man. The poor old fellow would probably have died if you had not called, Honorable Puss-Puss, said my guide, ruffling the old cat's furs. Then he turned to me, saying, "Good work, Lobsang. You have started well. Keep it up." Together we scrambled up the mountain path, both of us envying Honorable Puss-Puss, who danced and gambolled ahead. My guide entered Shakpuri, but I stayed, sitting on the boulder at the top, teasing Honorable Puss-Puss with a piece of bark, a nice, flexible piece of bark, which he pretended was some fierce enemy. He leaped and growled and roared and attacked the bark, and together we had the strongest sense of warm friendship. End of chapter 12.